have a microphone here, so fine. Okay, thanks, Alan, for the kind introduction, and thanks for the organizers for inviting me to this really beautiful place. Although I really have bad feelings just being the third week in the semester in Germany now, already leaving for California. You know, it's, but when we're here seeing the scenery, you don't feel about that so bad anymore. Okay, so what I'd like to tell you about is some of the last experiments we did in Munich before we moved the group to Mainz about the tungsten-radon gas. And this has been a collaboration between theory and experiments. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is actually theory. So the people who have worked on the theory and also had the general idea of how to do this experiment were Belén Paredes, Valentin Murk, and Georges Stapnikov and Ignacio Sirac. So I'm going to talk a lot about the theory as well to explain to you the experiments and the physics behind this system. And okay, so the people involved on the experimental side on this experiment, it doesn't reflect the actual group right now, but these were the people who did contribute to this work on the experimental side: Olaf Mandl, Arthur Videra, Tim Rohm, Thorsten Best, Simon Völling, Markus Greiner, and all this was done in the labs of Ted Hensch in Munich. And of course, now we are in a new location at the University of Mainz. I'll tell you about that. Funding for these experiments is coming from the German Science Foundation, European Union, Max Planck Society, and also some dollars flowing from the American Air Force Office of Scientific Research. Okay, so let me give you an outline of my talk after a brief introduction also on the status of the experiments in Mainz. I will talk about just the superfluid Mott transition as a reminder on how we can create strongly interacting systems in optical lattices, and then I'll talk about the tungsten-radon gas, which is currently in press in Nature and should be out pretty soon, I guess, and then I will conclude an outlook, give you an outlook on the experiments that we're gearing up to do right now. Okay, so let me just give you a status of the move, what we did. So a lot of our work was really also devoted towards kind of entanglement and quantum information, although kind of after November we've been a lot involved with disentangling very classical objects in our lab, and kind of before the move nobody wanted to really hear or see or speak at all about this move to taking down the whole experiment. But everything moved then in November 26, 2003, we moved the lab from Munich to Mainz. Well, actually, it would be nice if this truck would have been full, but this was the smallest kind of truck they had, so it's kind of was half empty or something. And we moved from Munich to Mainz, and if you don't know where Mainz is, it's actually very close to Frankfurt. It's just 20 minutes of Frankfurt, and of course, I'd be really happy if somebody of you is, if you're flying into Frankfurt and you'd like to visit, just give me a call, even on short notice. It's really close. It's just 20 minutes by train from Frankfurt Airport. So it would be really nice. So the current status of the experiment is the BC machine is fully operational again. 3D lattices should be up and running, I guess, this week while I'm talking here. And we're just gearing up for a new round of experiments. And I hope we will have some new results for you very soon. So let me now continue more to the science side and just briefly remind you of the system we're working in. Most of our work has been done in 3D optical lattices. That means we superimpose three standing waves on top of a magnetically trapped Bose-Einstein condensate. And this kind of has a typical simple cubic lattice structure that is created on the Bose-Einstein condensate. The Bose-Einstein condensate breaks up and populates something like 100,000 lattice sites. And we have something like 1 to 5 atoms on average per lattice site, depending on the densities and confining parameters we work at. Typical trapping frequencies of each of the harmonic oscillator potentials at each lattice site are on the order of 45 kilohertz, and something of the maximum lattice depths that we can create are 40 recurl lattice depth. So now there's been a lot of work on this superfluid Mott insulator transition. You know all about it, so I'll be very brief about it. That basically is a competition between two terms in this very fundamental Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian, the kinetic energy here, the interaction energy, on-site interaction energy here. And if you tune U over J by tuning the height of the optical lattice potential, you can go over from the superfluid state of matter to an insulating state of matter where these interactions dominate. And the important point I want to make about this interacting point where the interactions dominate is really that it's already some kind of feminization going on, because due to these strong interactions, the strong repulsion between the particles, they don't want to sit on top of each other. That's why they basically, under an ideal situation, which we don't have in the experiment, but in the perfect conditions, one could envisage the Mott state as being something like this, where you have one atom on each lattice site. And the particles just don't get on top of each other because the interaction, it costs them so much interaction energy to be on top of each other that you don't want to do that. And this, of course, this strong interaction, which lets them avoid being on the same side, is something like, somehow mimics Pauli blocking, right? So it's somehow like fermions that don't want to be in the same position in space, but we'll see there are actually fundamental differences. But so far, what I'm telling is pretty vague. So the connection I'm making between fermions and bosons, or the what I would call here fermionization, is very vague, as I say. And in 3D, it remains like that, and also in 2D, but we'll see in 1D, the situation is very different. In 1D, you can make a precise connection between the many-body wave function of a free fermionic system and the many-body wave function of a strongly interacting bosonic system, thanks to the work of Marvin Girardot, who is here also today. And I'll tell you about that. So let's go on to the 1D system and discuss the 1D system. So what do we have to have as experimental requirements to be in a one-dimensional regime? So there are several requirements for that, and I'll take you through those step by step. The first one really is that the chemical potential of your system should be much smaller than the radial confinement. So let's say you have a harmonic confinement, you have it very tightly confining in some radial direction along this axis and a weak confinement along the axial direction. So first of all, you should be in a situation where your chemical potential is much lower than the radial vibrational trapping frequencies. Then you should be somehow in a quantum degenerate regime to see quantum effects. And this means in a 1D situation that your temperature of your system should be below some kind of degeneracy temperature, although we know that in 1D there's no sharp transition temperature, something like in the 3D case, but somehow this degeneracy temperature can be written as number of particles in this tube, in this confining potential, times the actual energy of the actual frequency. Okay, so the experiments I'm going to report on here typically have aspect ratios of 100 to 200, and I would like to point out we're not the first to do 1D experiments with 1D condensates. So the first experiments with 1D condensates were done in the group of Wolfgang Kedeler, and then in the group of Christoph Salomon, and later on in the Lattice's work, what I'm going to tell you, the first work on 1D condensates was done in the work in Munich, in our group, Markus Greiner, 2001 PRL, and more recently we've seen very nice work in Tilman Esslinger's group, PRL, and also in Bill Phillips' group, which is, I think, ConMat. I don't know if it's published yet, Trey. I don't know if it's... Okay, anyway. Okay, shortly. So there's work on that as well. So how do we create these one-dimensional confining potential cubes? The idea is to work not in a 3D lattice, but in a two-dimensional lattice configuration. So you have two counterpropagating you have two standing waves that you overlap, and then you have no confinement along this direction, or only a very weak confinement due to the, let's say, laser beam wastes or the magnetic trapping potentials in your system along this axial direction. So you basically create an array of these potential tubes, which are extremely tightly confining in the radial direction, but weakly confining along the axial direction. And in that case, under our situations, we're going to work in a situation where we have something like 20 atoms per tube, so not very high number of atoms, but around 20 atoms per tube. Radial trapping frequencies around 35 kilohertz, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the actual trapping frequencies in a second. Requirements two. Okay, so this was one, to be in a 1D regime. Now you want to be in a Tonks regime. So what do you have to have in order to be in a Tonks regime? Well, there's something that you characterizes the strong interactions in the system. This is the so-called Tonks-Girardot parameter, which is basically the interaction energy divided by the kinetic energy. And to be in this regime of a Tonks-Girardot gas, you should have gamma being much larger than 1, indicating that really interactions are the most important physical effect in your system. Now, in the homogeneous case, this interaction energy scales like the one-dimensional density times the coupling constant, which characterizes the interaction strength between the particles. Kinetic energy scales as h bar squared, kinetic energy squared divided by the mass of the particle. And this then results in the gamma parameter, which describes this ratio of interaction to kinetic energy, to be mg divided h bar squared n. Now, this is a very peculiar feature. It tells you that the system gets more strongly interacting in 1D the lower the density is, and this is rather counterintuitive to a 3D case, of course, where when you're in a 3D case, you increase the density, the system gets more strongly interacting. Here, it's just the opposite way around, and it's due to the special scaling of the interaction and kinetic energy in the system in 1D. Now, there's been a lot of work on this, and I can't really cover all the publications on this. Just have a selection of work. There's been outstanding work by Maxime Olchani and his group, also by Jora and his group, and also a nice review by Marvin Girardot himself and Ewan Wright, which you can find in a laser physics issue. Now, what I'd like to say that under these one-dimensional strong interaction systems, if you're coming from condensed matter physics, you might be more familiar with describing these systems in terms of what people call Luttinger liquids. which is something that Haldane, for example, has invented and first brought into the community. And this can actually be applied to these one-dimensional quantum gases, not only for cases where gamma is very large and we're in a Tong-Schiardot regime, but also when gamma is in between. So this Luttinger liquid theory applies over the whole range. And one can, of course, if you're coming from condensed matter physics, think about how to describe these systems in terms of this Luttinger liquid theory. Now, the point is that we're working here in a very special system with a finite number of particles, a trapping potential. So what we need is actually an exact solution to the problem, because we cannot directly apply this Luttinger liquid theory in these cases. So we're looking for an exact solution to the problem under the case where gamma is large, where we're in the Tong-Schiardot regime. And this is really what lies at the heart of a Tong-Schiardot regime, is this connection that Marvin Girardot made in the 1960s between how to relate the many-body wave function of a strongly interacting bosonic system, which is here, to the one of a free fermionic system. And the idea is that, or the general point is, that the many-body wave function of a strongly interacting system in 1D is just the absolute value of the many-body wave function of the free fermionic system. Okay? So what you do is you solve for the eigenfunctions of your Hamiltonian for non-interacting particles, populate them according to Fermi statistics. That's going to be your fermionic wave function. Just take the absolute value of that, and then that's the many-body wave function for your strongly interacting bosonic system. And in general, of course, we can write immediately down what that means. Let's say, for example, our natural orbitals or our eigenfunctions of the non-interacting case are denoted by these phi i's. Then we just take the Slater determinant. This is this determinant here, which gives us the fermionic wave function. And then, of course, we have to take the absolute value, and that will give us the many-body, strongly interacting bosonic wave function. So the Slater determinant makes two things. It ensures, of course, that two particles cannot be at the same position in space. But, of course, we're dealing with bosons, so we need to have the right symmetrization. That's why we have to use the absolute value to ensure that the symmetrization is right. Sure. Right, absolutely. This is just for T, but what I'm saying now, it's just the ground state. Okay, so now when you have this...
Maybe you could just quickly comment.
Sure.
Why doesn't this type of idea somehow work for two and three dimensions?
Well, I think it's the ordering. You don't know how to order the... When you go through the system, the ordering is not clear. Let's say the minus one that you have to put in places there is not clear in 2D and 3D. That's, I think, the problem. And it's quite fundamental. You know, there's no, as far as I know, talking to theorists, there is no mapping, this kind of mapping in 2D and 3D.
Okay. It's a topological difference, as you point out. In 1D, the nodes, the points, are fixed. In 2D, the places where particles collide define hyper planes which divide the configuration space into disjoint regions.
Mm-hmm.
In two or higher dimension, they're essentially rods and lines in noise go round.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this mapping is really unique to 1D. That's an important point that you should keep. Okay, so then if you calculate some properties for the system, you will find that bosonic and fermionic system have exactly the same values where this absolute value of the wave function does not play a role. For example, if you look at the density distribution in the trap, for example, and then you calculate the absolute value of the many-body wave function squared, it's just going to be the same as the absolute value of the fermionic one. So there, the absolute value in the determinant, in front of the determinant, does not matter. However, if you calculate things like the correlation function, for example, which tells you about the phase currents in the system, well, then it's very different because the absolute sign really matters a lot, right? And of course, then if this is different, then by Fourier transformation, you get the momentum distribution, and this is going to be very different from the one of free fermions, but also very different to the one of non-interacting fermions. So just as a sketch here for the momentum distribution for, let's say, free fermions in the homogeneous case, you just fill up continuously until you reach the Fermi edge here. You just continuously fill up your momentum states, and this would be the momentum distribution for your free fermions. For the Bose condensate case, we would have a peak, a delta peak here. And of course, now, because we have strong interactions between the particles, between our fermionized bosons, well, then we don't have a delta peak, but we get something like this, just in a sketch. So the point here to make also is that the momentum distribution is something that is very characteristic for this Tong-Shuo-Do gas, because it's different from the non-interacting Bose gas, but also very different from the non-interacting Fermi gas, and very characteristic for the Fermionized bosons. Okay, so let me tell you about the experiments in 2D lattices so far on the Tong-Shuo-Do regime, on this 1D regime. Here we have gamma around, so far, 0.5 to 1, in this Tong-Shuo-Do experiments, and all experiments so far have been in the 1D mean field regime, although I'll talk in a second about experiment where higher filling factors have been analyzed recently in Zurich also. But so far in this Tong-Shuo-Do game, everything has been in the 1D mean field regime still. Experiments also showing very clearly that if you just make this 2D lattice, measure, for example, collective excitation parameters, you clearly get 1D mean field results. And you start to see slight deviations in the experiment in Bill Phillips' group in the three body losses, which are expected to occur because you're starting to see stronger repulsion between the particles. They don't like to be on top of each other. So the losses are beginning to become modified, but you're still in a regime where where gamma is not large compared to 1. So this is around 0.51 to 1. So what are the ways to increase gamma? What can we do to increase gamma? Well, of course, we could increase the scattering length itself if we have a nice Feshbach resonance. Of course, rubidium-87 is in that respect a little bit of a disadvantage, unless you can go to really high field values like Gett-Rempe does. The other possibility would be, of course, to decrease further the density, but then, of course, I mean, we already only have 20 atoms in the system in each tube. If we decrease much further, well, I mean, it's going to be not such a good idea, I think. But then, of course, there's another thing which I really did not see, and I think nobody else saw. This is really the ideas that came from Belén Paredes and Ignacio Sirac, was that, well, there's this mass to tune on, right? You can tune the mass. You can basically just add, let's say, a third lattice, work in a low filling factor regime where you just change the effective mass of the particles, right? And this is going to do exactly the same thing for you. It doesn't matter which of those parameters you tune, it's really irrespective, but this is really the new idea introduced in the field, and I think it's really important to say that this was not seen before by anybody else. So, how the general idea then is, you have this one-dimensional quantum gas, and you add a lattice in the third direction. Now, this doesn't have to be a very strong lattice, as I'll show you in a second. This can be a rather weak lattice, and this modification will already change the mass of the particle significantly, and will then lead to us to be able to enter this strongly interacting regime. Now, in order to apply Fermionization, this mapping theorem, we need a second requirement. That is, we need to work at low filling factors. We should not work in a situation where we have, let's say, two particles per lattice site. Obviously, any Fermionized theory could not describe this situation where two particles are on the same lattice site. So we need to work in a situation where the filling factor is much larger than 1, and the experiments where this high filling factor regime was explored, for example, has been recent work in Tilman Esslinger's group. So you can basically relate now, if you add this third lattice, you can relate this Tong-Shuo-Do parameter, gamma, just again to this magic value of interaction strength divided by tunnel coupling between the wells. And this tells you what your gamma is going to be, and then you can calculate that for these different lattice strengths that you add in these directions. Okay, so let me tell you about the experiment, how we did the experiment. So the way we do the experiment is the following. We first create the one-dimensional quantum gases by increasing the intensity of the two-dimensional lattice potentials. This is shown here in these sketches here. And we increase that, we go to a lattice depth of something like 27 Rico. So now we have these tubes, one-dimensional tubes of quantum gases. And then we ramp up, after creating this one-dimensional quantum gas, and I think it's quite important, the sequence of events for the physics that you're going to observe. After creating this one-dimensional quantum gases, we add, after some time, this third lattice here along the third direction with some different lattice depths, up to 19 recall, although the highest lattice depth, I'll tell you a little bit about that. So most of the experiments have been between 5 and 12 recall on the actual lattice depths. The atom number is low to be in this low filling factor regime, around 30,000 atoms. And we have a harmonic confinement. The actual confinement is around 60 hertz. Radial confinement, as I told you, is around 35 kilohertz. And then you just shut off the lattice and just look at the momentum distribution of the particles, because that's what you really want to measure. This is a picture of what you get in the experiment. So let me tell you about this picture. So the long axis of the tube is along this direction, along the x direction. This is where we add the shallow lattice. In the other directions, because of the strong radial confinement, the cloud expands very fast. That's why you're seeing the cloud extending very much in this direction. But also, if you would look in the third dimension, coming out of the plane here, there would be also a thin pancake coming out there. So it's like a pancake. You can envisage this. So it's a fast expansion of the quantum gases in the y-axis and the z-axis, and in the x-axis, that's actually the momentum profile you want to observe. So what we do is we average in order to create a good signal to noise, we average within this region the momentum profiles that we get. Here you can see these average momentum profiles. Now the challenge is for theory to fully explain these momentum distributions quantitatively using this feminization approach. Okay? So very simple question, but can we fully get a quantitative explanation of what we see here? Well, we start with some initial temperature. I'll come to temperature in a second, to temperature effect, finite temperature effects in a second. Of course, we could control it by just the initial temperature of the BC that we start with. But I'll come to temperature in a second, what we can say about temperature, because it's also an important point, actually, in these experiments. So now let me go on. How am I doing in time? I'm fine, I think. So let me go on to explain to you first the momentum distributions in a single tube, how they're modified by finite temperature effect, finite size effects, and different momentum scales, as you'll see in the problem, and then go over to see how we can relate these results for the single tube to the results of the whole lattice system. So here's a momentum distribution shown, a theoretical plot for the momentum distribution in a single tube. So here you have NFP versus the momentum in units of the recoil momentum of the system, four different filling factors in your system. So this is kind of just changing the number of particles you have on the lattice site. 0.5 just means that, say, on 1,000 lattice sites, you put 500 particles. And what you see is that if you're probing the system on a momentum scale, which is much smaller than this average, this characteristic momentum scale, which is just 1 over the average interparticle spacing, and is, again, just the Fermi momentum of the system. So if you're probing on momentum scales much smaller than the Fermi momentum in the system, you see the generic For the Tonks gas, what you would expect to see is the generic 1 over square root of p behavior. If you're looking on momentum scales much smaller than this characteristic momentum, this Fermi momentum. However, if you're probing the system on momentum scales larger than this characteristic momentum, then short-range correlation effects tend to increase this slope. It actually turns over, in the homogeneous case, I think, to a 1 over p to the 4 behavior. And this was shown by Maxime Olshany and also in work in Sandro's group and by Stefano Giorgini and in Monte Carlo simulations, that you get strong modifications from this 1 over square root of p behavior. So the important message to keep here is if you really want to see the 1 over square root of p momentum behavior, you would need to probe on very low momentum scales in the system. And I'll show also that there are other effects which will mask this 1 over square root of p behavior in the system. So just to remind you, because some of you, well, at least when I started in the field, I always thought I'm going to see 1 over square root of p, I'm going to see 1 over square root of p. But you have to be clear, you're only going to see 1 over square root of p if you're probing on momentum scales which are much larger than 1 over the inverse interparticle spacing in the system. Again, much lower than the Fermi momentum of the system. Second point is finite temperature. So we're not working at T equals zero. Of course, there will be phase fluctuations in the system. And these phase fluctuations also introduce a new momentum scale, which in our case broaden the interference peak, because phase coherence is not that long-ranged anymore. Having not long-range phase coherence means that low momenta are again going to be changed. So this would be the result for a T equals zero momentum distribution that you would expect, seeing the generic 1/2 behavior here for the low momentum profile, for the low momenta. For high momenta, this is modified due to these short-range correlation effects. Now you have finite temperature in the system, and you see how this modifies kind of the low momentum region where this tends to bends off, okay? And if you increase temperature even further, and it's best to measure temperature in the system relative to the tonal matrix element in the system, which is the characteristic energy scale. And if it's like here, even higher temperature, you get an even broader plateau before you see this power law decay here. So important thing here is you get a power law decay here, which on this log-log plot you just see as a linear slope here. This is rounded off at low momenta due to finite temperature, and at the high end you have these short-range correlation effects.
What kind of with exact diagonalization, or no, this is...
This is exact diagonalization. This is, yeah. Okay, so let me summarize the momentum scales that we have in this game. So we have this characteristic short-range, long-range correlation. This is just the Fermi momentum in the system, below which we observe one over square root of p behavior, above which we observe the short-range correlation effects. Then we have thermal effects in the system, which introduce an additional momentum scale. And something I didn't talk about so far is actually you also have finite size effects. So if the system is just 20 particles, has some finite size, there will be a cutoff in the momentum scales as well. So it turns out in our system, the following is true, that the finite size effects, this momentum scale is much smaller than the finite temperature effect. So we're, our experiments are dominated here by this finite temperature relative to the finite size effect. So finite temperature is most important for us. And this is also very close to this characteristic momentum scale, which separates short range from long range behavior. So we have to take all this into account to explain the momentum profiles that we see. So now let me go over from this homogeneous case calculation to a calculation which takes into account the harmonic confinement you have along the axial direction. So far the calculations that I've been showing you have been done for a homogeneous case, so no axial confinement. Now we go the next step and introduce a harmonic confinement to the system which we have in the experiments. So here are the results, again the momentum distributions for three momentum for three axial lattice steps, 5 recoil, 10 recoil, and 12 recoil. And for different temperatures, T equals 0, the black curve results, and finite temperature results are the orange curves, the red curve here giving a finite temperature of KBT divided by J being 0.75. Clearly, again, you see basically, you see the same effects. You see the rounding off of the low momentum profiles due to finite temperature effects. But again, you see nicely this power law decay here, power law decay, and for all those curves. What you actually also see is that the slope of the curve changes, gets smaller and smaller, and that's an interesting point, and that's due to the fact that that you're actually changing the filling factor in your system. It's not that the system is becoming more strongly interacting, it's actually you're changing the filling factor in your system. So why is that? So let me briefly talk about that. So already for low lattice steps, for 5 recoil, you can think of the system as being having an infinite interaction strength. The repulsions are so strong that the particles do not move on top of each other. However, due to the remaining kinetic energy in the system, the particles want to spread out. So they will extend to some part across this lattice potential in this direction. So for example, here for this 5 recoil case. Now, if you're going to decrease the kinetic energy in the system by increasing the lattice depth, the system, there's not as much kinetic energy in the system anymore, so the particles want to move to the center of the trap. Okay, so you're increasing the filling factor in the system. Eventually, you reach for these deeper lattice depths, you would reach for T equals 0, you would just nail it down to a Mott transition to reach this one, to this plateau here. All right? So why does this change in filling factor change the slope? Well, in order to understand that, we have to go back and show you here. Remember, if the filling factor changes, this characteristic momentum scale is actually pushed out. So if you increase the filling factor because the particle spacing decreases, this characteristic momentum scale is pushed out, and you're going more and more towards this from this steeper slope towards this shallower slope. Okay, so this is why the slope decreases, not because the system is getting more strongly interacting, but because you're actually changing the filling factor in the system. Well, here's just a cartoon how you can envisage those things. Of course, we can't imagine like these particles as point-like particles here, but just to give you an idea, as you increase the lattice depth, you quench the kinetic energy in the system, the particles just roll together at the bottom of the well. They do not move on top of each other because that really costs a lot of energy. If they would have to go on top of each other, that would cost you interaction energy, so they don't do that. But eventually, for deep lattices, you would form a Mott state. But before that, it's nevertheless strong interacting, and it's the Tonks gas. Okay, so let me just briefly come to the way how we average, take into account that we have different number of tubes, these 10,000 tubes with different number of particles in our case, and then show you the experimental results, conclude with that. And so the nice thing that comes out when you do the calculation on this, that you can basically calculate the number of particles on a certain lattice site, ij, by just knowing the number of particles in the central tube, which is really a nice result, and the total number of particles in your system. Or putting it the other way around, what we need for the averaging is what is the probability to have a tube with m particles in it, and this just depends on the number of number of particles in your central tube. Right? This is really a nice result because it has just a single parameter will tell us all about our probability distribution to find m particles in one of the tubes. And we use this probability distribution to average over the different momentum distributions of the different tubes. Okay, so now let me show the experimental results and the comparison with theory. So here we plot again in the log-log plot the momentum distribution of the kind I've shown you, the pictures I've shown you before. And these, the black lines, are the theoretical results based on the theory of fermionization. And I should say, I'll come to a more detailed discussion in a second. So here we increase lattice depth, and you see how the slope gets narrower. You see actually also you see the finite temperature effect, which leads to this rounding off here. But again, you see a nice power law behavior here, power law decay here, which is shows up nice as this slope linear part here in this log-log plot. Actually, if we fit a slope to this momentum distribution without the third lattice, turns out this slope is pretty much close to 2, which is what you expect for a quasi-condensate, what people have shown, for example, in the group of Alain Aspect, very nicely with Bragg spectroscopy, that what you expect is a Lorentzian momentum distribution, which would, of course, give a slope 2 in this graph.
Scale, 10 to the minus 1.
10 to the minus 1, 10 to 0, 1. That's right. That's right. We can go on, increase the lattice depth even further. And the thing I should tell you that this agreement between theory and experiment is we only put 2 parameters in this and then just have a calculation, ab initio calculation. So it's no fit. We just put 2 parameters in. That is the how many atoms do we have in the central tube? This is what I told you, which we need for the averaging. And what is the initial temperature of the quantum gas? What is the initial temperature here, which we take some of this finite T effect here. And then we calculate what temperature would be by assuming adiabatic evolution of the system. Okay. What is important to note here, if you want to get the temperature evolution right, you need to take the right form of the entropy, right? And in this case, for the fermionized system, you need to take the fermionic form of the entropy and not the one left for free bosons to get the temperature right. So I'd say there's an excellent agreement between theory and experiment based on this. I'll just show you here one selection for a 5.6 recall, which gives a gamma of 8. And the yellow and the green line, the yellow line is what one would expect for free fermions, the green one is what one expects for bosons, and the black line is what we get for the fermionized theory explaining the experimental results. Okay, I'll skip this part and basically just come to the outlook of the talk. So we've been able to enter the Tong-Schiradot regime in a two-dimensional array of one-dimensional quantum gases. The main point was to work in a low filling factor regime to add a third lattice to increase the effective mass of the particles and thereby enter into a regime of strong interactions. We observe excellent agreement with a theory based on fermionization. Actually, this first quantitative comparison also allows us to extract temperature information out of these systems, which is really, before that, everybody was asking me, what is the temperature of your system? What is the temperatures you're actually working at? And it was a question I really could not answer very well. But now we have a way to really, well, maybe it's not high precision yet, but some way of telling what the temperatures in our systems are. And this is, I think, quite important to work. Okay, so future work, something we're working on right now, is to implement the work we're doing on photo association in optical lattices to measure the correlation functions, the strong modification in the G2 that one would expect for such a Tonks gas, and I hope we'll have some results for you on that soon. Okay, so that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for a great talk. Are there questions or comments? Yes?
I really don't find the original idea about increasing effective mass convincing. And this is in part because the argument overlooks the fact that the lattice also changes the compressibility of the system. This is the first thing. Second thing is the argument doesn't take into account the fact that interactions have a finite range. But even putting this aside, you mentioned at the beginning the work by Haldane. And to describe these systems, people introduce the exponent, which is called correlation exponent. And if you have a free fermion limit, then that exponent just takes on a value 1, if I follow definition of, let's say, Kane and Fisher. Generally, correlation exponents are non-universal in one-dimensional systems. They can be changed by changing the interactions or changing the periodic potential. There are a few exceptions, and those exceptions are vicinities of the phase transitions. Then just universality of critical exponents dictates specific value of the exponent in question. Now, if you look...
Maybe I'm not getting the point. What is the question? Maybe you can...
What is the question? The question is that it seems to me that these results contradict what people know about the properties of one-dimensional quantum liquids in a periodic potential.
Because
I was trying to explain that before. Because there are only two places where this exponent corresponds to free fermions. One of them is the vicinity of filling factor 1, and another one is very dilute limit. To get the exponent at the free fermion value anywhere else will require fine-tuning. And
I should point out, I mean, what we're doing is basically, I mean, what's much more important, I think, than the exponent, what really lies at the heart of a Tong-Schiodo gas is really this mapping. Sorry, I'm going too fast over it. This mapping, right?
Sure,
about the real system. And we apply this mapping to the real system. We calculate the eigenfunctions. We calculate the eigenfunctions for the free non-interacting case and just use the mapping given by Girardot and calculate the momentum distributions we expect from that. Sure, but the gamma is already for gamma.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dilute. And gamma is already for 5-recall lattice. Gamma is on the order of 6 or 7. If you calculate the Luttinger parameter for that, it's 1.1, which one is the limit for the Tonks gas. So you're already there in a very strong.
I think he's going to buy you a free cup of coffee at coffee time.
Okay,
but it's interesting comment. Jora.
I just have a comment
on this comment.
Yes, I have a comment in order to avoid confusion. You know what has been done here, yes, like this, is that okay?
No.
Do you hear me? No. Okay, thank you. So what has been done here, always, whatever dilute system is or not, if gamma is infinite for the Tong-Girardot gas, you can use the many-body wave function as a modulus of the Slater determinant. That's general. And then using just this wave function allows to calculate correlation functions, G1, one-body density matrix. This is the exact solution of the problem. And then the exact solution cannot be wrong. Yes? So, Жень, ну прежде говорить, вы думайте сначала.
That's not allowed, Jora, not allowed. Are there any questions in the back?
Can I interrupt the discussion?
Okay, Adi.
Emmanuel, if I understand correctly, you have in the one-dimensional direction, you have the optical lattice and you have also the harmonic confinement. So if I look locally, it's like an optical, it's like a periodic lattice in an electric field, it is as if I take a periodic potential and put it in some electric field, and that would cause a localization over a stark localization over some scale. So
but you have to think like the particles are. The particles extend with their wave functions out throughout the system due to their kinetic energy. I mean, what the picture, of course, I'm drawing with these ball points is not correct. I mean, you should envisage like each particle is a wave and extends due to its kinetic energy over some extension in the bottom of this harmonic well.
So it
covers really not only like a region that which is exposed to a linear gradient or something, but it really covers a lot.
And how long is this extension relative to the
distance?
Well, it's
like what we showed here. I mean, this is what one gets out of the calculations. It's like extends over like something like 20 lattice size.
No.
Oh, sure, but this is like, okay, but this is like independent tubes. When these are decoupled tubes. So each of those tubes you can consider as independent. That's an important point.
Okay. It's nice being way back here. It's quite peaceful.
Emmanuel, what was your model for the distribution among the tubes? This magic five halves
one?
Or three halves?
This one? Okay, this one just assumes that basically in the radial direction of each tube, just have the Gaussian ground state wave function. In the axial direction, you just have a Thomas Fermi profile. And then you can calculate what the distribution, if you're given your total number of particles, you can calculate what is the distribution of atoms in your system for your given confining parameters, harmonic oscillation frequencies due to the Gaussian beam wastes. But if you do that, what only matters is the number of atoms in the central tube and the total number of atoms in your system. Or for the distribution of particles, it's just, again here, the total number of particles in the central tube, which is the important number you need to know the whole distribution of particles. But what we assume is just in the radial direction, a Gaussian ground state, and the axial direction, a Thomas Fermi profile. Overall tubes, yeah. Well, in each tube.
Another question here.
The equal chemical potential should be equal, yeah. Exactly.
Can we take a look at the data?
Sure.
With all the gamma
this
dependence.
One?
Yeah, this one.
Sure.
I'm also a little bit puzzled about the momentum distribution you talk about. And I will, intuitively, I would say the momentum distribution should depend on gamma, as the previous colleague mentioned. So my question is, why you haven't looked at the asymptotic limit, the very small p limit? Obviously, that small p.
Small p?
Small momentum limit.
Well, small p is limited by finite temperature effect, as you can see.
Yeah, but
here.
I mean the region widen up when you increase gamma. Right?
Okay, well,
if you go to the
the thing is just we don't have any signal there anymore. I mean, there's just no atoms out there.
What's
anymore?
Your largest gamma? You have another transparency, right? With larger gamma.
These ones?
It's much flat, yeah. So the small p limit is much flatter in the larger gamma limit than in the small
right.
gamma.
Right. So there is, okay.
And the large energy liquid theory is really about small p. No energy gamma.
No, sure, absolutely. I mean,
so if you look at the small p limit,
the problem is the small p limit is masked by finite t effects here. If you want to look at the small p, you cannot see the small p. It's extending more, okay, yeah. Right, so what I should say, actually what happens to the harmonic confinement is that temperature increases in the system, and that's also what the model tells us. But due to the harmonic confinement, in a homogeneous system, without the harmonic confinement, temperature would remain the same if you adiabatically increase, let's say, the lattice temperature.
Yeah, there's another question.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Let me put in another question. If T is really zero, we believe that the small key limit.
If temperature would be zero, well, then we should be seeing, if we really look at these below the much below the characteristic scale, we should see the one-half behavior. For large gamma. Yeah, for large gamma. Yeah, but already I'm saying, look, but already for the gamma, let me just point out, I mean, already for this, look, already for 4.6 recoil, gamma is 5.5. If you go into Luttinger liquid theory and calculate what is the K parameter, equivalent Luttinger parameter for that case, it already turns out to be 1.1 to 1.2. So it's very close already to the final k equal 1 power law behavior that you will get. So that's I think, the main
Another
point
question.
I want to make.
You mentioned that by using the one-dimensional weak lattice, that the main thing you are changing in comparison to the one-dimensional free gas is the effective mass. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, is the physics in this one-dimensional lattice exactly the physics of a free gas with a different effective mass, or are there changes, for instance, in the correlation functions? When you said you are in a situation where you never have double occupancy in a well, whenever you have two atoms in the same well, I start to wonder if you would now compare a free gas with an effective mass and would calculate G2 and G3 and compare it to an exact calculation in this one-dimensional lattice. Is there a difference?
I don't think so fundamentally that there will be any difference between these systems in the free gas.
Because somehow the lattice the modulation is some form of correlation which you superimpose on it, and I'm wondering if that affects G2 or G3.
Well, not if it depends on, of course, what scale you're looking again. I think it all depends on what momentum scale you're looking at. On a coarse-grained scale, on a low momentum scale, which does not take this fine structure into account, I think it would look exactly the same.
I'm forced to have one, let Sandro have the last word.
My question is closely related to the one of Wolfram. Concerned effectiveness. First, I would like to understand if you can estimate what is the increase of the effectiveness with respect to the bare value, by what is the factor of increase?
Well, I think you can read it directly off, because if the gamma, if we start around gamma 1 and we end up here, gamma 5, then it's like
the factor 5. Yeah. And second, if the physics is completely equivalent to the free gas with an effective mass, then one should observe the center of mass oscillation along the tube. Did you measure this?
No. This is something we
because
we
the frequency should be affected by the square root of the effective mass.
I agree. So I think this transport measurement and also like the correlation measurements are something definitely to do, and we're working on it.
I'd like to thank Manuel for a great talk, but also great questions, too.